I think it's college. Well, when did that
Okay, I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. We are February 27th, 2017, and it's great to have you all here. We are going to hear a couple of bills today, but before that, I want to, we have a committee bill that needs to be introduced, and then a quick work session on a bill that I think we had all agreed on. So I'm going to open a work session for the purpose of introduction of committee measures, and
Chair Dimbrough,
Senator Przanski.
Chair Dimbrough, I move that the following legislative concept be introduced as a committee bill, LC 3028, dated 10-20-2016.
Okay. Senator Przanski has moved that the following legislative concept be introduced as a committee bill, LC 3028, that is dated October 20th, 2016. Members and members of the audience, just to remind you that a vote to introduce a committee measure does not indicate in any way, shape, or form your feeling about that bill. It's just simply to begin the process by which the bill enters the system. It may or may not be referred to this committee. It may or may not be scheduled for a hearing at some point. So with that, is there any discussion of the measure?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so Vice Chair Olson.
and I smile and I laugh. You're absolutely correct. It doesn't mean significantly which way you vote, but as a typical protest that I will do on bills that I don't like, I will be no vote on this bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Przanski.
I don't know if I should be apologizing since it's not my LC, but it is dated pretty far back. I had to get all the dust off of it to read the date of October 20, 2016.
Yeah, it's sheepskin, I think.
It's cheap?
Sheepskin. Sheepskin. Okay. Hearing no other discussion, is there any objection to the measure?
Yes.
Senator Olson's been noted.
Senator
Bear-Trigger. Okay, measure carries. And I will close the work session for introducing committee bills. And I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 100. Beth, could you remind us of what this bill related to fuel oil dealer program does?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 100 would update the statutes that govern the state home oil weatherization program. You heard this bill on February 13th. There's a minimal fiscal impact and minimal revenue impact and no subsequent referral.
Okay. Vice Chair Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Dimbrough, I move Senate Bill 100 to the floor for a do pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson has moved Senate Bill 100 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Roblin.
I just really want to acknowledge that Senator has made the motion on Senate Bill 100, which has another history in our state, and I really appreciate it.
Back to 1973. More just.
Yes, we can forget about the date. It's the number.
Yeah, exactly.
But, Mr. Chair, the problem is these two senators have been here this long. You know that.
Okay, any discussion of the measure? Is there any objection to the measure? Okay, measure carries.
Okay.
And Vice Chair Olson will carry. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 100 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 276. Do the other one first?
Yeah, other one first.
Okay, I will close.
You can leave them both open.
Yeah, if anybody wants to talk about 276, but we'll first hear Senate Bill 745. And Senator Roblin, do you want to go down
sure.
and present?
And there's a couple other people.
Okay. All right. Bring a chair up. We can have four legislators at once. This is what we call a coastal quorum. Beth, Beth, you want to tell us what this bill does?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 745 would direct lodging tax revenues after refunds that are collected by the Oregon Department of Parks and Recreation for providing lodging at state recreation areas located along the ocean shore to a new Oregon beach fund. The fund would be used to pay OPRD expenses for managing state recreation areas along the ocean shore. There is a subsequent referral to the Committee on Finance and Revenue.
Okay, great. Thank you, Beth. Senator Roebling, did you want to start?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. This bill not only recognizes the history of the original beach bill, which is like 50 years old this year, it's also trying to figure out how do we make and keep the essential beauty of the Oregon coast for generations to come. You know, 362 miles of ocean beaches, the Oregon breathtaking vistas, recreational opportunities, and significant economic driver for our coastal communities. We know that it annually, just in the revenue that comes from visitors, about $2.4 billion a year annually for our state. And the thing they do most is walk on the beaches, spend some time there. We've found it's been harder and harder over the last number of years to keep those beaches pristine and clean. Different activities happening. And thankfully, we've had a lot of volunteer groups that come and spend time on the coast and clean it up. We had a dock getaway in Coos Bay and floated out around out into the ocean and got broke up on one of our beaches. Not an easy beach to get to, mostly styrofoam and other stuff, but it was all over everywhere. And if it weren't for a surf rider and a couple other groups that organized cleanups, it would have been crazy. When we had the tsunami that happened in Japan, a lot of stuff eventually made it back to our beaches and cluttered them. We have lots and lots of guests, and we have a lot of little communities along the coast that people love to come to and watch for whales and do things that have no tax base for the city itself. The revenue comes entirely from the people, the hotels, and the other kind of stuff along. Depot Bay is one of those communities. So up and down the coast, making the place safe for visitors that come and the coast, coming up with opportunities to figure out how the communities can continue to survive and get porta potties where they need to be, all the other kinds of amenities that people expect when they come to the coast and our parks and other stuff, it becomes a bigger and bigger difficulty for each of these places. So the idea was we're already collecting some money. Some of it goes to state parks. We would love to have a portion of that set aside in a fund, a beach fund, that goes for doing those other kinds of things, public safety, cleanup, all of the activities that help preserve the coastal beauty that we have. And in this fund, we'd also have the opportunity for outside groups to give money to it. Legislature, if we so desire to put some more money, we could. But it sets up an opportunity and a source where we can actually put money towards the things that are important to keep that the draw that it is for people from around the world. So would encourage you to consider this bill.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Krieger, you want to go next? Pleasure to have you.
Mr. Chair, thank you. You really have three legislators, and one has been.
Representative, I don't really appreciate that.
Do we get to choose? Or?
Just omit that. For the record, Wayne Krieger from Gold Beach. I received a phone call from Senator Roebling's office and was instructed to be here in Salem today to read Senate Bill 745 and be prepared to testify. My wife told me, because she received the call, that it was from some lady named Rosie. So I think you all know who that was. But Senate Bill 745 does deal with revenue from lodging tax collected by state parks, establish a beach fund, and describes in Section 1, Sub 4 through A, the type of uses that it would be intended for. Curry County, I believe, has more state park land than any other county, and I know it has more miles of ocean shore that's in state parks than any other county. Important in Section 4 in regard to managing state recreational areas along the ocean shore is the front that beachfront armoring sand management with C and H in the bill is responds to increasingly severe storm and erosion events. I'll talk a little bit about specifically state parks, but there's some other things I think that are very relevant and that are happening along our coastal highways. These issues were actually brought up in a panel we had at the Coastal Summit last summer that Senator Roblin and Rosie Reedy put together. And specific to sea, beachfront armoring and sand management and responses to increasing severe storms and erosion. Historically, in 1969, at least after the route of Highway 101, reroute of Highway 101, there was at least 650 feet to 1,000 feet of dune and vegetated area at Euchre Creek, right where I live. There's a big dike that goes across there. During these increasingly severe storm events, the ocean is now hitting Highway 101, and large boulders the size of a big chair, even larger now, are coming out from underneath the footing of Highway 101. These same type of events are taking place at Harris Beach State Park, Lone Ranch State Park, the park at the mouth of Chetco River. Also being affected are Cape Sebastian, Arizona Beach, Garrison Lake, Cape Blanco, Humbug, and Boardman State Parks that are all in Curry County. it's also interesting to note, because when the highway was moved, that Highway 101 from Euchre Creek to Port Orford is the most expensive piece of highway in the state of Oregon to maintain. It is, if you look at the figures, it's way beyond anything else in the state. Historically, the Corps of Engineers, DEQ, and Parks and Division of State Lands did not allow or want rocks and logs to be part of the armoring. I think this is going to be changing. Right now, the Corps of Engineers is, in fact, okaying the logs and rock under some circumstances. This, along with bioengineering, will allow for common sense to be applied to certain projects that we'd never be able to use this technology for, and we didn't even have it a few years ago. And a lot of it was aesthetics. When these mats are put in place in the vegetation, after a few years, you don't even know anything is there that's been changed or been altered by man. The State Parks and Recreation Department at this time does invest in some things listed in Section 1B. I hope the revenue from Senate Bill 745 will be in addition to those funds that are already being spent, and it's an ongoing problem, and I think it's going to get worse. If we want people to come to the coast, have access to those parks, and have tourists eat in our restaurants, stay in our communities, and spend money, we want to make sure those facilities are protected. And as you know, with $76, state parks is buying more land. And if they're going to have more land, they've got to have a way to maintain it and take care of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Coast, which reaches from Tillamook and the South Jetty all the way down to Yahats, the most beautiful part of Oregon, if I might add. I appreciated Representative Krieger speaking to the economic impact that our state parks and included in that, of course, our state beaches have on not only the Oregon coast but on the entire Oregon economy. But there's something else that I wanted to speak to today, and that is I stepped out of my Ways and Means Committee to come down here, and those of you familiar with the current Ways and Means environment, we're looking at creative ways to cover ongoing costs in a very difficult budget environment. And this is an answer to how we cover necessary costs in a unique way that we're facing right now. How do we take care of our beaches? I would say more succinctly, how do we take care not of my constituents, but of your constituents who come to the beach and find themselves unknowingly in harm's way from sneaker waves, from rolling logs, from a variety of different kinds of challenges? And the answer is that we've got to find a way to sustain our state park system and focus more resources out there where my constituents live and your constituents visit. And the answer to this is in large part that we are taking transient room tax dollars generated within the state parks and using those dollars to support our state parks. Let me say that again. We're not talking about diverting TRT money that's coming from hotels or bed and breakfasts or Airbnbs. We're talking about the transient room tax dollars that are being generated when people camp in our state parks or use yurts or other facilities in our state parks, and using those dollars to support our state parks. I think that's entirely appropriate, and I just appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today to comment on that. I'll also just mention in closing that that there's an identical and equally excellent bill over on the House side that has my name on it. I just appreciate you gearing this one up before the House got to their version.
I'm sure this is a superior version.
I am.
Representative Brock Smith, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Dimbrough. Appreciate all the comments. And yes, the Coastal Caucus has endorsed the bill that's on the other side. I don't know that Senator Roblin just didn't have Rosie go out and get those signatures for you. But we have, Representative Gomberg and I have the support on the other side, but which we'll be more than happy to support over here.
We're hoping you eventually get it here.
It's a pleasure to be in front of you and discuss this bill. I can't really add much to what already has been said, other than to reiterate the safety. We just lost two souls in my district on the beach that weren't from my district visiting that beach. I can't tell you how many times as my 4 years as county commissioner, the sheriff's search and rescue was dispatched to the beach, beaches within Curry County for life safety issues that occurred. Representative Krieger discussed the issues as far as armoring and sand management that is occurring because of the rise in sea level and the increase in severe storms. And we're talking about a diversion, as Representative Gomberg discussed, of less than $120,000 annually to assist in preparing our beaches for your visitors and ours for now and in the future. We don't do something, the problem isn't going away. And I understand that this might be the first controversial bill of the session. At least for our side, I just encourage your support and appreciate the time.
Thank you, Representative. Colleagues, any questions for the bill? Okay, thank you all for bringing this bill. Okay, let's have Representative Terry Thompson come up, please. And with him, Carmen Matthews and Ian Roger, please.
Well, you had all the state representatives up here.
Probably.
I'm so old they forgot I was here. I'm Terry Thompson, Lincoln County Commissioner, and that's who I'm representing. And, of course, we have a section of the coast that's very active with tourism. We see a very critical issue here, and that's the education. And that's part of this bill, part of it says that you're going to do more education to our tourists. We have lost a lot of lives over the years that I've been on the coast to such things as people playing on drift logs and being on rocks that shouldn't be. And thank goodness for our Coast Guard helicopter. They've saved a lot of more of them that wouldn't have been there. But this is a good bill. It's the right thing to do at the right time, being the 50th anniversary of the beach bill. I can't think of a better time to reassure the people of the state of Oregon that it's an open beach, but we want to make sure it's a safe beach and a clean beach for them.
Thanks. Commissioner, before we go on, how are you imagining doing that kind of educating? What do you do now, and what could you be doing better?
Well, first of all, if I had unlimited funds, I'd make sure that every hotel room has a pamphlet on beach safety that was in it. Right now, we do signage at the beaches. We talk about the issues of what you can and can't do. And then, of course, on every modern, or one of the bigger hotels, they usually have a television screen, and I'd probably do a film that could be played onto the television, their own network, so that we can show people about why they should do what they do, especially related to logs. That's one of the big things that's got so many young people that just don't know. And if they could see how that log acts in the surf, they'd realize that's a dangerous thing to play with. that's the things I do.
Great. Thank you.
Chairman Dimbrow and members of the Committee of Environmental and Natural Resources, thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Carmen Matthews. I'm from Coos County, Coos Bay. I'm here to speak in support of this bill as a business owner, a citizen of a coastal community, surf rider member, and just ocean enthusiast. In addition to all the points that have been brought up in terms of safety from outside logs and rocks and everything, there's a lot more that I see that is important to this bill. First one, just personally, the economics and economic importance of a clean ocean environment is vital for many of us on the coast. It's a huge natural tourism draw for us. I know my business benefits from having the ocean nearby, and I believe a clean beach speaks for itself in terms of tourism. Also, it's a key reason for why many of us live near the beach. For myself, I grew up on the beach, and it's a huge part of why I live there and why I want to be a part of the community that I live in. Now, having a clean beach is something that we really pride ourselves on in those coastal communities. For a lot of our coastal communities, the businesses we identify as ocean-themed in a lot of ways, and so that is also another way to tie it into the economic impact. We identify as a clean ocean environment that you want to come visit. And when the state of our beaches are in an unsafe condition, it directly affects our community in many ways. Whether it's the families not wanting to visit the beaches anymore, or people not wanting to come back once they've visited, and we've seen that with dangerous substrates, whether it's logs and rocks, but also just inundation of people living on our beaches. We had that happen in our community, where it became kind of an unsafe place to be. Now, as a surf rider member, we do beach cleanups very regularly, and we see the seemingly endless demand for investment in time and money to keep our beaches clean. The safety and cleanliness of our beaches and recreational sites seems to rely widely on volunteers to respond quickly to dangerous situations created by ocean debris, like Senator Roblin mentioned with the dock that broke apart on Lighthouse Beach. It was a huge problem, and it was extremely dangerous and dangerous to remove as well, and we did that with a lot of volunteer hours. I don't think the state should rely solely on volunteers to keep the crown jewel of our tourism industry clean and safe. I think a baseline fund to help keep these recreational sites from sliding into poor or dangerous condition would benefit our environment, our communities, our businesses, and the people who visit the greatest asset of our state. And I also believe this is a great way to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Beach Bill, and for all of those who want to visit the sea. It's just a great way.
Thank you very much, Mr. Matthews. Mr. Roger.
I actually just came to sit in support of my cohorts from Coos County.
You did well. Thank you.
I guess
thank
we don't you. Get to answer
any
questions, huh?
Okay. Well, that's right. There'll be more. Okay, next let's have Bill Perry, Robert Bailey, and Todd Bulkowitz.
That is expanding the use.
This is a mix of proponents and opponents, so please, everyone, behave.
Go ahead. You pronounced my name right, so I'll behave.
Okay,
good afternoon, Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you so much for allowing us here today. I'm here to support this bill. Again, my name is Todd Buchholz. I live in Coos Bay. Up until 4 weeks ago, I was the area manager for the Bureau of Land Management, Umpqua Area Manager. And one of the biggest responsibilities I had as that manager was public safety. And the buck stopped on my desk as far as public safety goes. When I first came to that position in Coos Bay, Bastendorf Beach was kind of, just kind of putzing along. The wheels were kind of starting to shake off the bus a little bit. We were cooperating pretty much hand in glove with Coos County Parks and Oregon Parks, trying to keep the wheels on the bus. And then all of a sudden, it all went south. We had a dock cut loose. We had a huge homeless issue that just invaded Bassendorf Beach. We had hypodermic needles, human fecal material everywhere. We were cooperating again with the state parks to help clean this up, but we were stretching their resources. We were trying to convince our federal partners back in Washington, D.C. that this was a big deal, and it was falling on deaf ears. We did not have any money in our back pocket to address some of these contingencies that come up when normally you're just moving right along, nice and easy. But if we would have had an extra $30,000 or $40,000 to put up guardrails, put up boulders, to deny access to all these interior places where a lot of the homeless people were going, we would have fixed that problem in a couple of weeks. It took us almost 2.5 years to leverage that dollars out of Washington and some of our partners. And in the meantime, we had one suicide, two murders, and not to mention just a lot of tourists were getting on social media and they're going, we're not going to Coos County. That place is a disaster area. So I'm here to advocate for having a little contingency money in the back, and I think this bill would help us do that. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Buchholz. Mr. Roger. Go ahead. Bailey, sorry.
Mr. Rogers.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Robert Bailey. I'm here today as a board member of the Oregon Shores Conservation Coalition. The coalition's been around for 45 years and was formed really to advocate for the Oregon's beaches. We are fully in support of this bill. We've been talking with Senator Roblin, Representative Gomberg, and Surf Rider Foundation all along about it. We think it's really needed. We are advocating the future of our beaches, as was said, a crown jewel. It's really one of the signatures of the state of Oregon. And this is a good start for as a vehicle for the resources in the future that we need through state parks to maintain this this treasure. So we're fully in support. We've got 1,340 volunteers that walk the beach through their Adopt a Mile program, and we're eyes and ears on the beach all the time. We think this is a good thing to do. Thank you.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you very much. Bill, welcome.
Thanks. Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Perry at the Oregon Restaurant Lodging Association. And we are obviously here in opposition to the bill, but I do want to state that I don't think that anything's been brought up today isn't a need that I think needs to be addressed. The question is this the right vehicle? And we talk about tsunami, we talk about homeless populations, you talk about a lot of different things, which are obviously needs, but should the statewide lodging tax be the revenue source for that? Because I think you will all find in your own districts, you've got different things that could be somewhat related to tourism or not related to tourism. If we start parsing off the state lodging taxes in those different areas for those different programs, you just erode this base very fast. And so there are different avenues that I think we would support. Obviously, when we passed the lodging tax last time, we set up a program where you could do grants. There's more money going to the regions through the RCMP program, which if it is truly tourism related and they can make that statement, then there's a lot additional monies there. We supported as an industry and an association the flexibility for the state parks to raise their fees in these certain areas that are more directly related. So, you know, I do think there are avenues afoot for these types of things, but to say that in different areas we're just going to take the state lodging tax away and put them in a fund without knowing, you know, is it tourism related or is it not, is just a dangerous way to go. And so we've got the state resource, and it's for promoting the state as a whole. There are avenues inside that to go after some of these local programs, but, you know, we would appreciate it if we went through the current situations or current opportunities to try to address them in different ways instead of just taking the money away and sending it in different places. So I'm supportive of the programs and what they're doing, and we'd be happy to help. I just don't think that this is the funding mechanism for it.
Thank you. From your discussion, sir, it sounds like this is a South Coast problem. By what you talked about, the homeless and the needles and all of that stuff, I have a place in Florence, and my place, I directly connected to the Sayulsa River all the way up to the lighthouse, And I don't see this kind of, I see the ocean moving things around, logs and things like that, but I don't see the homelessness, I don't see the debris and the problems that you have. And I'm not against this at all. I just, is this something that we're focusing on to repair a social problem on the South Coast, or are we really intensely looking at the entire coast?
My experience was on the South Coast, but I know through my Forest Service and BLM colleagues up the North Coast, they're finding the social issue, i.e. the homelessness. But we also see from surf riders, and I forgot to mention that I'm part of the surf rider organization as well. There's a, yeah.
Separate, what is the surf riders?
Oh.
Go ahead and explain.
I'm a valley guy.
You live in, yeah, well, you have a place in Florence and you don't know surf.
No, riders. I don't.
And I don't surf, so I'm going to just put that out there already. Surf riders was a group of surfers who organized, who were swimming around in the ocean one day and saw that it was polluted with human fecal material and all this. They founded an organization which is worldwide, which is dedicated to clean oceans, estuaries, educating our youth on, you know, best practices and all that kind of stuff. So we put together beach cleanups about once a month all the way up and down the coast. There's chapters in Newport and in Coos Bay. We clean up tons of material every year. And it's not just from homeless, it's, you know, from just...
From everywhere.
Yeah. From everywhere. And so some beaches have it worse than others just because of the hydrology. But in our particular case in Bastendorf, it was a rather harmonic convergence of just way too many crazy things. That it was free camping, for one. And that brought in a whole bunch of homeless folks. But it just, it's my point was, is that... Whether it's homeless, whether it's a dock that gets cut loose, whether it's a house that's falling off a cliff onto the beach, there's these odd moments that happen that need somehow some money to go out and fix, hopefully before they happen, because it took forever to get that dock taken care of or the house that was going to fall. And so for 10 cents on the dollar, it's easier to fix something before it happens than not. So that was my point.
Follow up. I believe you gentlemen down there had another slight problem with a little boat that came up on the shore and you tried to burn it up and you broke it in half.
We didn't. It was the federal government tried to do
that. And you drifted it off. No, I'm only kidding you.
That wasn't the BLM. And I'm retired from that now.
That was on the other side of the bay from where this particular Boston
I wholeheartedly agree with you that probably these funds are necessary because of the fact of certain situations that come up. But, again, I agree with Mr. Perry in the fact that, you know, is this the proper resource? Because we raised hotel motel taxes to pay for a sports venue in Eugene. And is this the appropriate piggy bank to take it from? That would be my only question.
Well, my only response to that is my experience with the federal government, where we take use fees that we generate out of campgrounds and plow them back into those campgrounds. They don't go back to Treasury to go into the black hole of the United States Treasury. So those funds, even though they're not that much, they do go back into fixing the toilets. They do go back into paying for our summer youth hires, where we get new kids coming in. That's oftentimes their first exposure to real jobs is when we hire these summer kids to come out and clean up the campgrounds. And I know State Parks has those same programs. So someone asked about how do we get kids in and education. One of those ways to hire them, you know. And so this, I would see, is plowing that back into those campgrounds that generate those funds. Seems just something I've been used to for some odd years with the feds.
Mr. Chair, this bill is, the funds are dedicated only from coastal lodges?
Parks. Only from coastal parks.
That we own.
And they charge the lodging tax, just like anybody else. So the hotels have a lodging tax, and state parks campgrounds have lodging taxes. And it would take that lodging tax from the state parks and readdress it instead of going to the other fund. It would go, yeah. And
okay.
Yeah.
Yes, please. Yeah.
Chair Dembrow, and I guess I agree with his point, but remember, you're adding 1.5% or 1.8% on top of whatever they're charging. So from our vantage point, if the fees for staying at the parks isn't high enough to cover this, they should raise those fees or any of the other fees. Because remember, this is only 1.5% on what they're charging. And so that's the distinction. If they need more money, and that's why we're saying we agree with flexibility to make sure that they can cover their costs, but if they can't cover their costs under their existing fees, then they should be raising their fees to cover their costs. From our, that's what a hotel operator would do. They wouldn't come back and say, I'm not covering enough, so I want to keep the tax. They'd raise their rate for staying there high enough to cover the cost.
So, Mr. Chair, do you know what those fees are, Ernie?
I can't tell you right now because I live there, so I don't go. Yeah. But we can figure that out real quickly. State Parks
out of curiosity, that's all.
And I think, as I understand it, one of the other features of the bill is to create a fund that would be partially filled with these fees, but also could be open to additional contributions. And I should have asked you when you were down there, Senator, but are there any thoughts about what potential sources might be for repositories? You know,
there are. Well, we could have a conversation in the legislature about getting some extra money in it if they see the need for doing some of those kinds of things. The other one is that there are nonprofits out there. Surfrider puts a lot of money into our beaches. Most of it is by muscle and feet and hands and whatever. But by setting up the fund and capitalizing on the 50-year anniversary of the beach bill, I think there are people out there who would be glad to donate. This bill allows that.
Okay, thank you all.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Al LePage, Charlie Blyben, and Rob Bovet, please.
Good afternoon. My testimony today can be summarized.
Can you start with your name for the record, please?
Oh, name is Al LePage.
Thank you.
My testimony today can be summarized in two words: exceptional exception. The Oregon Tourism Commission, doing business as Travel Oregon, is an agency primarily funded by a 1.8% statewide transient lodging tax. Travel Oregon's mission is to inspire travel that drives economic development. Through innovation and partnerships, they share the stories of Oregon's people and places, deliver world-class experiences, and ensure the preservation of Oregon's way of life and natural places. Travel Oregon is literally an award-winning agency, and in a word, exceptional. A recent January 2017 report prepared for Travel Oregon included information for the Southern Oregon Coast region. Here's three excerpts. Not surprisingly, beach activities are the most common denominator for visitors to the Oregon coast.
So, LePage, can I just interrupt? You don't need to be so close to the
mic. Oh, am I too
close? Extremely
too close.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Just get it
sure.
A sort of comfortable distance.
There you are. Is that better?
It is.
Sorry about that.
No, it's fine.
Shopping, visits to parks. So, beach activities are the most common denominator for visitors on the Oregon coast. Shopping, visits to parks and historic sites, and hiking, backpacking are also popular. Also, for day visitors, Sunset Bay State Park is the busiest of the region's 11 state parks. The park hosted 1,360,000 visitors in 2015. Of the four parks that offer overnight camping, Bullard Beach State Park is the busiest destination. The park hosted 105,000 overnight visitors in 2015. And lastly, data about visitation to parks is another source of information about visitor volume. Visitation has rebounded past pre-recession levels. In fiscal year 2015-16, the 11 state parks in the southern Oregon coast hosted 4,300,000 day-use visitors and nearly 250,000 overnight campers. Wow. Over 4 million visitors and almost 250,000 campers on the south coast alone. And so I think it would be a reasonable jump to expect such high numbers would also be found on both the central and north coast, too. This information alone strongly suggests that the beaches and state parks of the Oregon coast in and of themselves inspire travel that drives economic development, that their very existence markets them. The Oregon Parks and Recreation Department's agency request budget narrative for the next biennium notes, the Oregon State Park System, one of the most popular in the nation, delivers consistent, high-quality direct services to more than 50 million park visitors each year. It symbolizes Oregon's commitment to a healthy environment and provides critical access to nature and the outdoors for the people of the state. The 92-year-old system is a national leader in protecting natural and cultural resources, creating memorable outdoor recreation experiences, and helping to generate environmentally based local economic activity. The working capital necessary to operate the park system comes primarily from user fee generated other funds and constitutionally dedicated lottery funds. In a word, the Oregon State Park System is also exceptional. It's also a vital resource, one that significantly attracts visitors with resulting major positive economic impacts around the state and especially along the coast, given the large number of state parks located there. The mission of the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department is to provide and protect outstanding natural, scenic, cultural, historic, and recreational sites for the enjoyment and education of present and future generations. And the agency also has jurisdiction over the ocean shore. And as Senate Bill 745 clearly states, there are many potential issues along the Oregon coast that need to be addressed, from visitor safety, emergency responses, beachfront armoring and sand management, marine debris, increased and expanding recreational use, increased tourism, a growing demand for beachfront development, and responses to increasingly severe storm and erosion events. So here's my pitch. Simply, given that Oregon State Parks has jurisdiction to manage the ocean shore, in addition to their other coastal recreation areas, and given the fact that the agency's own facilities for camping and other lodging, such as in cabins and yurts, generate lodging taxes that currently go to Travel Oregon, that it would seem, unlike typical commercial lodging that's not usually an attraction in and of themselves, that Oregon State Parks is, in a word, an exception. In other words, unlike typical commercial lodging, the beach and state parks already are some of the big attractions on the coast that essentially market themselves. Also, since the agency has to deal with ocean shore issues, that Oregon State Parks are an exception in the sense that they should be allowed to keep the lodging tax they generate through their own campsites, yurts, cabins, and other overnight facilities at coastal state parks, such that they do have the additional funding needed to address the unique issues presented in coastal recreation areas. Overall, therefore, Oregon State Parks is the exceptional exception. Finally, our interest in this bill, as the nonprofit National Coast Trail Association, working to complete and maintain the 400-mile-long Oregon Coast Trail from the Columbia River to the California border, a significant portion of which uses the coast 200 miles of beach and 150 miles of existing inland trails, many within Oregon State Parks. Our interest in this bill is enhancing the ability of the agency of state parks to do what needs to be done to provide a quality recreational trail experience to visitors along the entire length of the Oregon coast. Therefore, we support Senate Bill 745 to establish the Ocean Beach Fund, direct the amount of transient lodging tax revenues from state recreation lodgings along the ocean shore received by OPRD to this fund, and to spend its monies for the expenses of managing state recreation areas along the ocean shore. Thank you for listening and this opportunity to speak.
Thank you very much, Mr. LePage. needs to play by.
Thank you, Chair Dimbrow, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Charlie Plyben. I'm the Oregon Policy Manager of Surfrider Foundation. I have submitted some comments here with all kinds of references to the importance of our beaches, the economic value, and the cultural significance. We've been here a little while, and we've heard a lot of that support already, and so I'll allow you to read that in your time. And would probably like to focus more a little bit on some of the questions that were raised about who Surfrider Foundation is, for one, why we see this as a good bill, and maybe some of the other questions that sort of arose along the way. So I'll start with Surfrider and who we are. We're a nonprofit environmental organization dedicated to the protection of oceans, waves, and beaches. So what that means here in Oregon is we have a chapter network. We have a Coos Bay chapter. We have a Florence chapter known as the Siuslaw chapter. We have a Newport chapter. We have a Portland chapter. We have a Curry County Organizing Committee, and we have a Clatsop County Organizing Committee. So I know you've heard from a few folks here on the South Coast, but I wanted to let you know that I do have experience working with our chapters and volunteers throughout the state of Oregon on many of the issues that were raised here. And I could cite some specific examples from each of the different regions along the coast if that behooves the committee. We are urging your yes vote on Senate Bill 745. For us, we have been asked to step up more than once to support our state parks. This doesn't just happen in Coos Bay. This happens in Newport. This happens in Cape Kiwanda area. This happens in Clatsop County, in Tillamook County. We respond to what we call rapid requests. That means that we don't have the staff to respond to an emergency situation on the beach. One of our volunteers mentioned the fact that that's kind of a scary place to be in when we have volunteers responding to emergency situations for cleanups or for other safety issues when we don't have enough people within the park system to respond to those. Certainly there are ways that we can address that with people. There's ways that we can address that with education. We enjoy our partnership with the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, and we think that they are best fit to make sort of those decisions about how that money would be invested. I want to speak a little bit about how this money is generated, and really the insignificance of this in a sort of statewide tourism budget. Because I think that was a concern that I heard. I heard from the restaurant and lodging industry, and I think that was raised by Senator Olson as well. You know, to give you a quick snapshot, $17.8 million was the state tax revenue, lodging tax revenue statewide in 2015 as reported by the Oregon Department of Revenue. This fund would take just less than 0.6% of that money that's generated directly from parks, campgrounds. We've heard this, which I think there are, check with parks, about 19 along our coast that offer overnight opportunities. So this doesn't include all the private sector. All of that money, which is the lot share of the $17.8 million, is going right back into tourism. So we don't think that this fraction of a percentage makes a big difference. Moreover, that money is increasing by about 14% each year, according to the Oregon Department of Revenue's 2005-2015 state lodging tax report. We could assume that if that money is at a growth rate of 14% per year, that we might not miss 1%. It might not be that big. You might not even see that difference if you have a growth rate higher than that. Further, you know, these lodging industry, they benefit from clean and healthy beaches, but they don't manage them. So I think it's pretty important that, you know, we are investing to make sure that these areas are clean and accessible so that people will stay at these lodging facilities and also at our state campgrounds. And we're not suggesting that we even touch the funding that comes in through the lion's share of what raises state lodging tax dollars, which is the lodging facilities. So again, only a few coastal campgrounds here. This is a way to retain funds for state parks rather than partitioning them into a much larger budget. And we like that concept. It's the 50th year anniversary. We think this is a great renewed investment. I looked at some numbers from volunteer hours that are donated each year. You know, I'm sure this group is familiar with Solve. Since 1967, when they were formed, they have contributed $60 million worth of volunteer hours to the state of Oregon. $60 million worth of volunteer. People care about our beaches. They will give for our beaches. But we can't depend only on our beaches. So it's $100,000, $115,000 from the state to hang on for their money, keep that in a management plan for our parks, a smart thing to do in the 50th year anniversary. I think it sends a good message to all those volunteers who dedicate a lot of their time to keeping our places clean and accessible. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. Rob.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Ovett, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties, but here today representing the Oregon Coastal Zone Management Association, better known as OCZMA.
There's an association for everything.
There's an association for everything. OCZMA represents the interests of counties, cities, ports, and other small local government units all along the Central Oregon coast. I'll just keep this real brief. First, ditto to what you've heard from the other proponents, including Charlie and the representatives and the senator. I would just add that this was not even a close call at the OCZMA Legislative Committee, who has representatives from the North Coast, the Central Coast, and the South Coast. OCZMA Legislative Committee unanimously endorses this bill and urges its passage. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rob. Questions, colleagues? Yes, Senator Bircher.
Thank you. This is just a little tidbit for the surf riders. You said $60 million in volunteer hours. How much is a volunteer hour worth?
I do not, Chair Dembrow, Senator Bartsugar.
Good job.
Thank you, sir. I do not speak on behalf of Solve, and I should make clear that this is not an endorsement from Solve on this bill. I read a document on Solve's website last night to try and get an idea of how many volunteer hours they put into, Oregon. So I can't tell you how that number is figured. Generally, I think it's about around half of minimum wage is where a lot of other interests will put volunteer hours. I know that other organizations have put them all the way up at $18 to $20 an hour. So that would be a good question for Solve. I'm happy to follow up on that if you'd like.
Great. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Senator. Senator Robles.
Beth was nice enough to show me that a yurt is $51, $28 for an electrical hookup campsite, and then there's some other little things you can pay along with that extra vehicle, $7 and so on. So,
how about just a tent?
I think it was 28. Was that what it was?
It depends on
well, that's a full hookup. 19.
It also depends on which campground you're at, because I looked at another one and it was like $30 versus $28 on the full hookup, $53 for a yurt and stuff, hiking, camping for bikes or $5. Those are usually walk-in.
Yeah. This is Bullard's Beach, which they mentioned was one of the most actively full places.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for the panel? Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thanks.
Really appreciate what you had to offer. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on Senate Bill 745 who hasn't signed up?
Oh, I should say one more thing.
Okay, Senator Roble.
Just a statement. Senator Brzezinski probably has not. I don't know if he's been to Coos Bay, to a little pub there that we have there, Seven Devils.
I know the place. I know the address.
So one of the people I've up here was one of the people up here was their owner. So I just wanted to make sure.
I think we've met before because we sat there and talked at one point after they just opened.
That was just acknowledgement of the beer caucus. And
yes, thank you very much, and thank you for and thank you for serving.
Yes.
Time for a field trip. Okay, so with that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 745 and reopen our public hearing on Senate Bill 276. And Beth, could you tell us about this?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 276 would declare it to be state policy to ensure a coordinated, effective response to ocean acidification and hypoxia, and would establish the Oregon Coordinating Council on Ocean Acidification and Hypoxia. There is a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator, come forward, please. I remember this issue coming up back when I was doing my first tour of duty as chair of this committee.
That's right.
I assumed we had solved this problem already.
Thank you for the question, Senator Dembro, Chair, and rest of the committee. Arnie Roland for the record, Senate District 5. Actually, Oregon State has done a good job of solving one part of that problem, figuring out how to adapt to it so that we can have an oyster industry again. So I appreciate the fact that you did that. The problem is that maybe other people thought we solved the problem as well. So that's why we need this bill. Probably the most important bill of the session, okay. Just so you know. And it hasn't collected a lot of attention, but the reality is our coastal nearshore is in danger from ocean acidification and hypoxia, and they seem to go together. The hypoxia issue, you know, a couple of years ago, it was really in the news a lot. We had these big Dead Sea places, and they had pictures on the bottom of the ocean where everything was just annihilated, nothing was living, in large part because lack of oxygen down at the bottom had killed everything. The ocean acidification is another issue. It goes along with our carbon in the atmosphere. And the thing that I think is most interesting about ocean acidification is that no one disagrees with that because we measure it, and it's pretty clear to measure it. We have probably one of the most unique places on the world with regard to what's happening with ocean acidification. We are the highlight area on the West Coast. Because of the upwelling that comes, we have this big current that comes around Alaska and down the coast, and then every summer it upwells, and we get this really rich, full of nutrient water that kind of makes all the rest of the wildlife here and the sea creatures bask in this wonderful area. The problem is that because of the carbon in the atmosphere, and over time it gets drawn in, and then with the chemistry of the ocean creates this slightly acidic water that has become a little bit more and more acidic over the years. And one of the things that I've told people, we had our hearing the other day, and the issue was adaptation. How do we adapt to this kind of change? And what we're asking here in this particular bill is to look at the kinds of things we can do, because we know that this upwelling, the water's 30 years old, 40 years old. It's coming over here all the way from Japan, coming around that underwater current and upwelling here. So no matter what we do, we've got increasing ocean acidification on our coast for the next 30 or 40 years. And you're going to hear from some scientists who are probably the premier scientist in the world, clearly on the Oregon coast, when you hear from Francis Chan here in a few minutes. But we're trying to figure out how do we, as one state in the list of states and provinces on the West Coast, come up with a concerted effort to continue to work with this. There have been ongoing scientific research and science organizations meeting up and down the coast to talk about this. From my perspective, we need to have a place at Oregon State University that is the premier, because they are the premier. When everybody else was wondering why were all the oysters dying, it was research at OSU that kind of figured out what the issue was in this ocean acidification. A few months ago, our new Science Trust Fund, Ocean Science Trust Fund, brought a bunch of the scientists together, about 20, 25 from all over Oregon, to talk about this particular issue in Newport. And I asked the question about, so what's the next thing? If larval stage of oysters are dying, they can't form their shells, so we don't have oysters, and we lost our entire West Coast group back in 2007, 8, or 9, right in that area. We had a real hard time producing oysters. What's the next little creature out there that we have to worry about? And they said, well, in labs, the next creature is probably the mussel on the Oregon beaches. Well, we don't have a big mussel production place at Oregon State. We have a oyster research that's going on there. We don't have a lot of places that are making oyster larvae, that are making mussel larvae. So what happens if in the natural condition that's out there, our ocean acidification gets to the point where their larvae can't reproduce? Do we stop having mussels? Some will live for a while, so we're going to have it for a while, but will there be a point when we don't have them anymore on the coast? And that's the concern. That's the reason we need to have the scientists here working and figuring out ways from which we can adapt and our creatures can adapt to a changing ocean chemistry that's out there. And with that, you need to hear from the experts. You need to be able to ask the questions. You need to understand why this is really a critical issue to us. the next groups that fall, if krill and other kinds of ocean creatures, right now the coast is where this ocean acidification is happening the most. It's not out in the deep ocean yet. And weirdly enough, Coos Bay doesn't seem to have the same problem as other parts of the coast. And there's research going on at Oregon State right now to try to figure out why is that happening? Can we learn from that? Other things that we've learned fairly quickly is that Neatarts Bay, where we have our one oyster production facility for raising the larva, because of Oregon State and all the research they've done, they found that the best time to take water out of the bay for their oyster production was in a bright sunny day. Because when there's bright sunny day, you've got seagrass all around. They suck carbon out of the water, and all of a sudden you have better water. So is that what's happening in Coos Bay? Is it important for us to make sure that our kelp beds and everything else are really healthy if we want to help augment this? That's why we need to have a center of excellence with respect to ocean acidification and apoxia. And I look forward to hearing the rest of the testimony and look forward to answering any questions that I can for each and every one of you.
Mr. Olson.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator, for bringing this forward. I know it's important to you coastal guys. We valley guys are a little different. But just a couple questions on the bill itself. And you said that in Section 3, you recommend prioritize state action to address ocean acidification and hypoxia, developing optimal strategies for mitigating the effects of ocean acidification and hypoxia. But in your statement, you talked about the ocean. They've been, for 30 years, they've been traveling our way. So how do we in Oregon mitigate those waters that have traveled from the far west?
I didn't think anybody was going to ask that question. That's a really great question.
I know.
That's why we have oyster production in our state right now, because we had scientists who went out and figured out the problem and said, okay, if we're going to have hatcheries for these oysters, what do we need to do? So there's a machine called the Burkulator, named after a scientist at Oregon State University, Mr. Burke, that takes, as the water comes in, it measures all the chemistry. And then they have other machines that add, well, I don't care what you want to call it, Pepto-Bismol, whatever you want, so that they can take the acid down to the level that it needs to be to raise healthy larval. And so what are other things that we can do? They are doing research right now with respect to oysters about, is there a way that certain of these larval stages succeed in a little more acidic water? So why don't we, like we do in other agriculture, work to find those animals that can handle a little higher acidity. So it's that kind of research and that kind of knowledge that we hope that our scientists can help us with to start mitigating it. When it comes to other critters, we've got to figure out what that means. We don't know the answer to that. The mitigation, as we talked in our last one, it's adaptation. How do we adapt to this changing world, which we know is coming? And if we give enough time, we get enough money to our scientists, they can probably give us answers to help us deal with that. And that's really a big part of the reason the bill.
Mr. Chair,
we do have people from OSU.
I think Senator Roblin owes me a good question, though, because I just gave you one, so you owe me one back when I testified.
I would be glad to answer you.
We'll all help.
Great. But before I let you go, Senator, sure. There's a West Coast kind of collaborative group on ocean acidification, right?
Yes.
And how do you see this group interfacing with that group? And is this something that each of the states on the West Coast are moving to develop?
Yes. Both Washington and California have begun some of that. It makes me a little frustrated because we have the scientists that really have the best knowledge and are really working at it, so we should be that lead. And I think most of them see our scientists at Oregon State as the lead scientists around the country and the world, not just here. And so I think we need to be involved with that. I think BC is also working on it. We'll see if Alaska, I don't know when you can hear from Francis Chan when he comes up and ask him about those. But our scientists have been a part of those collaborative conversations amongst the scientific community since its beginning, and look forward to continuing that. And I think Oregon needs to be that place that is the pinnacle of that, because in fact, if you look at where upwelling happens and how it happens, we are the epicenter for this particular ongoing issue.
Okay, thank you very much, Senator. Yep. Okay, so I'll call up Francis Chan, Jack Barth, and Andy Lehner, please.
Thank you.
That's great.
Lanier? I'm sorry.
I'll sit next to you.
Okay, Dr. Shan, you want to
start us off? Good afternoon, Senators. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you. My name is Francis Chan. I'm an associate research professor at Oregon State University. And what I do there is I study how coastal ecosystems work. And most recently, I co-chaired a panel of 20 scientists from BC, Washington, Oregon, and California. Jack Barth was a member as well. And we were convened to provide a state of science assessment of the issue of OA, ocean acidification, and low oxygen or hypoxic zones. I'm here to share some of our findings and also to speak to you about SB 276 and what that would mean for ocean change readiness in our state. And instead of, before I dive into some of the science, I just want to attack that last question. What would SB 276 mean? And I'm going to build on Senator Roblin's comments. It really means Oregon leadership on a global change issue, number one. Number two is that it means getting ahead of the curve on challenges that will get more and more difficult to deal with if we let it. Changes are coming, and we need to be prepared. And last, it's about taking advantage of the opportunities that we have in the state, and opportunities meaning both the research, the partnership, and the policy expertise to get ahead of the curve and maintain leadership. So that's the three things that I think this bill means. I'll talk a bit about what ocean acidification is. So ocean acidification is the global challenge of changing water chemistry. The ocean serves as an incredible sink for carbon dioxide. It absorbs about 1 out of every 4 molecules of CO2 that we emit. This is an incredible service, right? It's dampened the rise of CO2 in the atmosphere, but this service has come at a price. The amount of carbon dioxide that the ocean has absorbed has started to change its very chemistry. It's lowered its pH, and it's made it more. It's making conditions that are less and less favorable for marine life. The science is very, very clear on this, but what is less clear is what it means for our incredibly productive coastal oceans along the West Coast. So the panel that I co-chaired, which was the West Coast Ocean Acidification and Hypoxia Science Panel, so a scientist came up with that, obviously, we were convened to use the best available science to try to answer that question, what does it mean for our West Coast systems? And more specifically, we were asked to attack, one, is ocean acidification and hypoxia, low oxygen, is that a really substantial threat to our coastal states? And if so, what options are actually available to us? Simply put, no one really wants to be behind the curve in this issue. The science of ocean acidification has really grown rapidly over the past decade, and I want to share with you how our understanding has sharpened over that time period. So a decade ago, when I first looked at OA, I confess that I thought of it as a bucket list problem, that this is something that is really far off and in the future, so that when my son retires and he wants to have that scuba diving trip in some exotic place in the tropics, that he's going to see a reef that's less vibrant than it ought to be. But the science that we've done over time has really changed that understanding. So what we understand ocean acidification to be now is two things, that some parts of the ocean are much more vulnerable than others. And in fact, the West Coast and Oregon are really some of the most sensitive areas to ocean acidification. We're the ground zero for this global phenomenon. And so this is the distance part. And the time part, this is not something that's going to happen in 50 or 100 years from now. Instead, it's already here. We've already changed chemistry measurably so that it's already impairing the survival of marine life on our coast. We can go out in a couple of months and start to measure some of the most acidified conditions that we have in our nation. So over the past 10 years, we've also come to understand that this isn't simply an oyster problem. You know, my family half love oysters, the other half could not care. And, you know, what we come to realize that the oyster industry, not only were they the first, but they are not going to be the last industry to be affected by ocean acidification. Every day, and we do this in my lab where we challenge organisms to changes in chemistry, the collective scientific understanding builds day by day. And in the past year, we've added things like rockfishes, Dungeness crabs to the list of organisms that we now know scientifically to be vulnerable to ocean acidification. And those are things that, as Oregonians, we care quite a bit about. We've also come to understand that for us on the West Coast, ocean acidification and hypoxia, low oxygen, they really go hand in hand. Some of what I do in my day job is that I convince grad students and technicians that it's okay to throw this very expensive piece of ocean sensor into the ocean, because we will get it back and we'll get some data from it. And when that happens, what we see is that whenever we see these low oxygen or dead zones, we see that those are also areas of the most acidified water masses. So they're really going hand in hand. And as a scientist, what this means is that if I study only one part of the problem, that's not a viable strategy. And I think for a manager, it also means that if you address only one part of the problem, you're not likely to be successful either. So what can be done? You know, initially, there was a lot of thinking that because ocean acidification is a global challenge, it's coming at us, it's because of global CO2 emission, that at the state level, this is something that the strategy should be, we should let it happen to us. We'll sit back and watch. And as scientists, we can do a really good job of documenting exactly how bad it's going to be, and we can start to identify which is the next industry that's going to be affected. We can do that as a scientific community. But instead, when we look at the actual science that we have available, as a panel, we conclude that there are actually things that we can and probably ought to do to address ocean acidification and hypoxia, or just ocean changes. I think we submitted a flyer, a two-pager that summarizes some of the findings. But to break it down, the roadmap really involves two paths, right? There are actions that involves mitigation, so lessening stressors that are where they're important, that may be compounding the problem. And the other is adaptation, supporting and enhancing the ability of fish populations, ecosystems, and also coastal communities and the state to best cope with the changes ahead. Those are things that we can and should do. And it's, in a sense, that's pretty abstract, but let me try to talk to you about how this is translating in our state. Right now, I work with a group of citizen scientists up and down the coast where we're installing pH sensors right on the rocks. So for the first time, we have a map of how ocean acidification, what are the hot spots and what the refuges are. So this is giving us some guidance about where we need to pay attention. As Senator Roblin remarked, well, the oyster industry has been working with university researchers, my colleagues at OSU, where they not only identified the problem, but they found a solution to the problem so that they can actually now adjust the water quality to maintain operation. And researchers are also looking at ways that perhaps seagrasses can actually improve local water quality. I have a grad student that's putting sensors in Coos Bay right now. So I'm really proud to say that these kinds of examples that I just listed that we have initiated in Oregon, they're being replicated not only across the West Coast, but nationally. I've had the opportunity to talk with state legislators from Florida, Pennsylvania, Maine, California, Washington, where I've been able to share these success stories out of Oregon, and I think that's really important. And I'll end by saying that about 6 years ago, I gave one of two talks at a Rotary Club meeting in Eugene, where I'm from, and I was talking about hypoxia, low oxygen zones, because there's tremendous appetite for ocean science in Oregon. It's fantastic. And I ended the talk by saying that, well, I just talked to you about the problem of low oxygen, but here's something that this is the next thing. Ocean acidification is the biggest challenge to ocean ecosystems that you've never heard of. And to go from that conversation at a Rotary Club meeting to this point where you are considering a bill to attack this question, I think this shows Oregon leadership. And thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Chan. We'll come back to you. Dr. Barth?
Chair Dembrough and members of the committee, I'm Jack Barth. I'm a professor of oceanography at Oregon State University, and I've been working off the shores here for about 30 years. So I've seen these changes that we've been talking about. My present job is as executive director of the Marine Studies Initiative at Oregon State University, and I'm going to circle back to that at the end because it's a partnership that we're looking forward to with the state agencies and to focus our efforts on ocean acidification. So I'm thinking back to that conversation we had about Oregon beaches, and we did submit a two-pager about ocean acidification. We also gave you a YouTube link to this video on ocean acidification, and give that a look if you have time. But the image on the front right is ocean beaches, rocky headlands, and then there's some water next to it. That's our ocean. And when you take a look beneath those waves, like Dr. Chan has done with these sensors, things are changing. So with ocean beaches, we can see it with our eyes. We need those sensors to measure the changes in the pH. And then you go further and look at the communities. Senator Roblin talked about the devastation we saw from the low oxygen. Well, ocean acidification is coming on. It's coming across the Pacific in these low oxygen waters, high CO2, and they're slightly acidic. They're brought up right next to the shore. So it's these communities that are going to start to suffer. Why Oregon? Well, it's got this upwelling that was described, but we've been looking at the ocean and studying it, and we've actually written the textbooks on how coastal oceans work, how the ecosystems are maintained. We know about these low oxygen zones and ocean acidification. The other thing about Oregon is we have this long history of partnering. If we want to get something done, it's the academics, the fishermen, the state agencies, the community members, and we work together. I can tell you it's very different when I talk to my East Coast colleagues and when they want to get something done. So this bill gives us this opportunity to keep that partnership going and get the work done. We've been out in front of the science. As I said, take a look at the video. We participated in the West Coast Science Panel. Out of that came efforts in the governor's office to get all of us involved in the whole West Coast, both as a leadership and as to be in cooperation with the other states. So the Oregon Coordinating Council on Ocean Acidification Hypoxia that this bill establishes really gives us a chance to be back in that leadership role. We established the science. As Dr. Chan has said, we influenced the way the states are going. Let's get Oregon back in front. We want to harness the knowledge of our scientists, the practical experience of our successful fishermen and shellfish growers, the deep capabilities of our agencies, and our ability to educate and train. I was pleased to hear about training about beaches and beach hazards. Same thing about our ocean. It's about that next generation. In the bill, it mentions the establishment of a center of excellence at Oregon State University under the Marine Studies Initiative on ocean acidification hypoxia. We have the scientists, we have the educators that can really push this forward, and we want a team with the council to thoroughly analyze and figure out solutions like Dr. Chan has talked about. We want to ensure that healthy future for our oceans and the planet. So we're expanding our research in many places, including ocean acidification. We're building a new facility out on the coast. And I wanted to remark about the coast versus the valley and central Oregon. Seafood is this thing that we all love, and it pulls us together. The Dungeness crab is the state crustacean, right? We all love them. It's not just a coastal issue. So this new Marine Studies Initiative, coupled with the bill and the establishment of the council, will allow us to move forward on that. So it'll give us that connection to the rest of the West Coast Initiative, and it'll emphasize the partnership we've been doing. So we very much look forward to partnering on this, and happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Barr. Ms. Lanier.
Chair Dembro, I actually was not intending to provide testimony today. It was a mistake when I put my name down on the form. I'm new at this, but I would like to take the opportunity.
Give us your name for the record.
Yes, my name is Andy Lanier, and I work with the Department of Land Conservation and Development as a ocean and coastal program staff, the Marine Affairs Coordinator. And what I would like to do is actually to answer a question that you asked earlier, which is how do we coordinate with our partners up and down the West Coast on an issue that's global in scope? And the answer to that is that we have intersection between this proposed council and with members of citizens and practitioners in other states. Last fall, we as a state signed on to the West Coast Ocean Partnership. And one of the priorities that they identified is to make sure that we're all coordinating on changing ocean conditions. And this falls directly in line with that. So, great. Sorry for the mistake.
No, thank you for that. No, that was useful. Questions, comments? Yes, Vice Chair.
Thank you for either of the doctors. We have five oceans on the Earth. Are they all now becoming more acidic?
They're becoming more acidified, yes. And we can, there, and so the there's some places that are much more vulnerable because of ocean circulation and basic chemistry. And, you know, we thought it was going to be the tropical reefs because there's a lot of things that build a shell that's vulnerable. But it turns out that it's a place like the Oregon coast where we have a problem of old water coming up that has fairly high CO2 in it to begin with.
A follow-up?
Yes.
Or is there any connection between the El Nino, La Nina cycles to the acidification?
I'll take that one on. So the El Nino cycles, you know, every 3 to 5 years, and it does change the local ocean conditions. It warms up. Sea level gets slightly higher by about that much, which contributes to more erosion and movement of the sand. That warmer water from the south does change the ocean conditions such that it actually ameliorates the acidification a little bit. But then we'll get a year like this year where we have lots of storms, lots of wind driving, and more of that upwelling. So the way to think about it is the acidification is increasing, but just like with anything, it's got some ups and downs from year to year.
And then one last, if I might.
Sure.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I really appreciate it. Underwater earthquakes, do they have any impact on the acidification? Because there seems to be an awful lot on the Far East of the seismic activity. We have some along the coast too, but does that have any impact on the acidification of the ocean?
I can take that one. So that's generally a seafloor phenomenon, and we're talking about waters that get up into the light zone where we have production of algae and consumption by organisms. So they are unrelated. There is one connection, though, and that's over in the Mediterranean where there are active CO2 vents that puff out during the earthquakes, highly acidic water where organisms are suffering extremely from high CO2 related to the geothermal activity. Okay. But off our coast, no.
Hmm. Thank you.
And is that a particular problem because the sea is fairly contained, that it has that much impact?
Yeah, contained, and the sources of that CO2 are close to the surface and in the light zone, unlike our 3,000-meter deep earthquakes.
Great, thank you. Senator Bertschinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are the sodium levels in the ocean going down that neutralizes the acid? I mean, you're talking about the CO2. Is there something going on with the sodium, the salt levels in the ocean?
So the sodium does not change response to increase in CO2. The carbonate does. So in my lab, and this is what I do with my students, you know, I take a seawater sample and it has a certain amount of buffering in it, just like Tums, and you can add a little acid, and up to a point, it stops buffering, and we have a big pH change, and that's how we measure alkalinity in the water. So we do this in my lab, and so what we do know is that that's changing very, very slightly over time, but the main part is that we're just adding the CO2 at a, you know, pretty fast clip.
Thank you.
I have a question. You know, we're often asked to choose between the problem of carbon emissions and adaptation to climate change, or in this case, to acidification, hypoxia. My sense is we really have to work on both of those, right? I mean, your focus is on adaptation to something that's underway and is likely to get worse,
right?
Hopefully not as bad as it could be if we do take action with respect to emissions. How do we juggle those priorities from your perspective?
Well, I guess for me, it's very immediate because we know that if we don't do anything on the adaptation side, then those natural systems and those communities will not be in a better position to withstand the changes. That's very clear. Whether those are competing priorities, you know, I don't know if the resources are the same, but you know, we see tangible results, and we know that efforts are already underway across the U.S. West Coast. And this is another example of, you know, Oregon exporting expertise. I'm going to go to California, you know, in 2 months where there's a task force on California seagrass mitigation at 2408, and I'm serving on that because, you know, other states are trying to get ahead of the curve on this one, and they're trying to see can they use seagrass to better the water quality.
If I could just add, I think that the adaptation and those immediate measures are needed. As Senator Roblin said, the water that's out there is 10, 20, 30 years old. It's coming on. Even if we made changes in our emissions, we wouldn't see that for, you know, 30 years. So we've got to deal with those shorter-term aspects now.
Right.
And maybe I just add that knowing that it's coming means that the adaptation investments you have will absolutely be worth it. Because if you didn't know it was coming, then you know you might easily say, well, let's not do so much adaptation. But we know it's coming, so you will see rewards and returns on those investments.
Fair point. But arguably, if we do nothing on the emission side, the problem is just going to keep on getting exacerbated.
That's true.
That's
as well.
Correct.
Vice Chair.
Just one last question. Is there any historical data to show that this has happened before?
To show the kinds of conditions that we have, so as scientists, we love looking at the other reference points to see, you know, is this natural or unnatural? On the auction side, I've looked at the past 5 decades of auction data, and what we're seeing now is abnormal from that 50 years record that we have off the Oregon coast. And if you want to look at the kinds of conditions that we have in where we are in ocean acidification, you have to go back to about 54 million years ago when, you know, very radically different Earth climate. That's when we had the kinds of rapid changes in rapid increase in CO2. But actually, that's actually slower than what we're doing now. So unfortunately, we really want a nice analogous event, but to look, you have to go really far back in time to find something that is like what's happening now.
Yes. Has anybody done any studies on the historical peaks and valleys of ocean acidification or hypoxia or anything like that? You know, like from back to 1800 or when measurements could have been possibly made, or scientific, looking at the shells of mollusks or whatever to see what they did?
Yeah, so there is that there's that shell record where you can look at isotopic evidence that have we changed the CO2 and the pH and C in the ocean, and that confirms it. We have a measured record going back for CO2 going back to the 80s. And in the past, so to go back in the past, you really have to...
You say the 80s?
Yeah,
1980s.
Okay. So to go back further, you really have to rely on those kind of geological proxies, but also modeling and kind of first principles. Because, again, you know, I can take a seawater sample with today's atmosphere, and I can, in my lab, I'll give myself a 1750 atmosphere, and I can, you know, measure the direct changes in chemistry as a result of that.
But just to reiterate or clarify what you said, we're seeing very rapid changes now.
These are the most rapid changes.
Even if you go back 54 million years, you can see changes, but over a much longer geological period, right?
That's absolutely right.
That's correct.
This is unusual.
The pace at which the changes are happening is unusual.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said this water is 30 years old, so where is it coming from?
Sure, I can take that one, and I'll encourage you to watch our cute little video about that.
I will watch it. But.
So the waters that are found about 300 feet deep off our shores come from off northwest of Japan. So that cold, dense water rises up and meets the atmosphere. And the CO2 from the atmosphere goes into that water. It then travels across the North Atlantic slowly over tens of decades and reaches our shore. North Pacific, excuse me.
Wrong ocean.
North Pacific. And then gets right to our shore, and then this wind-driven upwelling brings it right up to our coast. So it's that decade-long, 20, 30 years that it comes across the North Pacific.
Okay. Thank you. I have a question. The good chair mentioned the fact that we need to do something now because of, and you just mentioned the fact that it comes from the west of us. So the impact we have our output for CO2 is extremely small. We're 0.25% of the entire world. This obviously is being predicated by what Japan, China, and the Far East countries are putting into the ocean. So how do we mitigate their inclusion into this by what we try to do in our state?
About building a wall.
Politically incorrect.
Well, of course, the mitigation we're talking about is for the local effects on the oceanic waters that are where the organisms are growing.
But they're not creating this problem in Japan.
It's a worldwide CO2 emissions into the atmosphere.
So CO2 exchanges very quickly in the atmosphere, so a molecule that I emit today has almost equal probability of ending up in the eastern North Pacific as it does here. So just that, you know, we have these atmospheric winds that really mixes the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Senator Roblin, thank you very much for bringing this.
Absolutely.
This is a really important bill.
Thank you for your attention.
So with that, I'm going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 276, and I'll talk to the sponsor about scheduling a work session. Okay. Colleagues, just a reminder that Wednesday we are meeting in hearing room F again because we're meeting jointly with the House. So with that, colleagues, we are adjourned.
Slow a little bit. They want to see it drop. Slow a little bit. They want to see it drop.